Okay. Today is Friday, February 20th, 2009. This is LTUE, Plot Promises.
Can you start the channel? If you have empty chairs next to you, if you wouldn't mind moving stuff often so people can sit. We still have a lot of people looking for a seat. So, yeah, we could do the thing they do at church. Everyone, please move into the center of your row and leave the aisle. Okay, welcome to this panel. This is a panel on... Sorry, I can't remember all the words and titles. Following through on your plot promises. Okay, for this panel...
There's a seat here.
Basically, we set up premises. Promises... Yeah, I can't talk. It's 5 o'clock. It's been a day. We're setting up promises for the readers in the first chapter, first few chapters that we write, or even just in the genre that we choose to publish in. So we're going to talk a little bit about on how you follow through on that promises and what happens when your readers feel cheated to have a guest. So let me introduce myself. I'm Alita Clegg. I'm moderating the panel, and because I can't talk, right? Yes. Tracy knows my brother-in-law really well.
Yes, I do.
You should go say hi to Scott. He loves him.
Where's Scott?
He's still in Orem's same house.
Yes, he will be.
Because I'm pretty great. Okay, personal stuff.
How
are
you doing?
Thanks.
He's doing great. He's still running his RuneQuest game every Saturday. My kids go now.
Sorry.
Okay, I'm moderating the panel. I don't have a whole lot of experience with this. I've written a lot of manuscripts. I finally managed to sell one. My first book is coming out this year. So I don't have any disappointed readers yet. If you're interested, I've got business cards you can link to me and get all the information about when it's coming out. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Cliff Johnson. My first book is actually coming out June 9th. Middle grade fantasy Green Dragon Codex. It's being released by Wizards of the Coast imprint Mirrorstone, and so I am riding Tracy's coattails for all their work. I'm all for it, go for it. All right. Thank you very much. And I write mostly historical fiction and fantasy for adults, kids. I've written a number of different things.
Hey, my name is Chris Park, and I am actually a high school teacher by trade. I teach creative writing. Hey, former student right there. I teach creative writing and science fiction fantasy and literature at high school in Orem. And my third book should be coming out September or October. It's the Personal Prophecy series. And
I'm Tracy Hickman. And I drive cocktails around quite a bit. I write books. Fat books. Probably not. You all know who I am. We're all good.
I am Julie Wright. I write.
You're Julie Wright. I am your biggest fan.
I've got a restraining order, but.
They didn't actually deliver it, okay?
I'm Julie Wright. I have a bunch of books out. My next one is coming out in July, which my editor informed me is going to be just amazing.
Okay, well, let's start things off with a question then. How do you set up this promise for your reader? I mean, it's never stated explicitly this book is going to do this for you. So how do we get that implied promise, or how do the readers perceive it in the book? So as writers, how do we build that in?
I guess I'll start. I think a place where it may begin is with genre. This is one reason why it is so important to read in the genre that you want to write, is because your audience is going to bring expectations to the table. And the only way for you to learn them is to be a part of this discourse community. You have to kind of speak the language in order to speak to your audience. if we all know there is a very pronounced difference between fans of hard military type sci-fi, right, and softer sci-fi, right? If you speak like you're writing a soft sci-fi with a more subtle element of the speculative element, then a hard sci-fi audience is going to feel betrayed. They're going to feel like you're not talking to them. So the very act of choosing what type of story you want to tell is establishing part of the contract with your reader.
I was going to say pretty much the same thing. When you write a genre piece, there are, if he says, expectations. But you don't want to play into the expectations to the point where your story becomes predictable either. And so to set up promises, a lot of times you can, it's all about character development. Give them little challenges at first to kind of set the stage for something that's to come. Foreshadowing would be a clear element that any story should have. But again, you don't want it to become predictable either by letting your audience so thoroughly buy into the genre expectations that they may be bringing with them that you can't still surprise them.
We can't hear you back here.
Oh, sorry.
You're going to have to talk much louder.
I'm done. It's history.
Okay. Last year I wanted to do something different. And so I proposed a YA series, actually, that was based on Greek mythology. And we sent out the proposal, and a proposal came out and said, wow, we really like fantasy, but nobody's interested in Greek mythology. Couldn't you do something like with dragons in it? Of course, because this is my job, I wanted to do something they wanted to buy. So I revised the entire outline, moved it into a more fantasy setting, put in the dragons, and, you know, a bit with the dog, and we sent it out. And it came back and said, this is just too much like everything else we have. So, the first rule is that everybody wants something that's the same, except different. It has to be unique in the same old way that is recognizable. And so, yes, we have to deal with genre issues when we write books. One of my least favorite is the fact that everything must be written in threes. It just has to be. Why? Because our great forebearer, J.R.R. Tolkien, wrote such a fat book that the publisher would not publish the whole thing in one volume and said, we have to chop this up into three pieces.
And the number shall be three.
And the number shall be three. Three shall be the number. Four is right out. You may write up to two, but only if you proceed to three. My dear partner and friend, Margaret Weiss, did a series of books on one of our most interesting characters in Graceland. There were two books written. There were ever only to be two books written. But every time we go anywhere, in any public place, when is the third one coming out? There is no third book. There was never a third book. We've thought about just writing a, you know, like a three-page piece and calling it the third book. Just so someone would quit asking. But here it is. Just take it right here. it's interesting that we get lost in these particular conventions because it makes it so difficult to do something new. And people, and when somehow someone does something new, very often it is difficult to receive because it is outside their experience. The principles which my wife and I then were writing, we actually envisioned it as 9 books. It was a trilogy of trilogies. And so the overarching storyline, which was supposed to take place over multiple generations of characters, was all known to us in our heads, and we saw this structure from the beginning. But that meant that the end of the first 3 books didn't have a big core. It didn't, you know, we didn't hit them with a big chorus at the end so they knew it was over. And consequently, our publisher said, wow, these, you know, nobody gets these books. And so we couldn't sell them the other 6. We couldn't finish the story arc because the publisher could not see where this was going. Could not envision anything other than a three-book trilogy set of fantasy books. Even though Margaret and I had written a 7-book series prior to this, which also had its problem with 3 books. We put out the first 3 books of this series and of the 7-book series, and people wondered why it didn't end. And we also tried to explain to publishers who should know better that there are people who will not buy a set of books until the 3rd one's out because they just want to read right through them. Which means that book sales for the first book are very low. The 2nd book is better. The 3rd book is where you finally start to get accurate sales in fantasy. And even though they have published fantasy for all of these years, they still do not understand that. If the 1st book and the 2nd book do not perform overwhelming, they'll never go beyond that. So we have to actually fight these expectations sometimes when we're dealing with these books. In some ways, especially for people who are just getting into the industry, it is best to know the form and write to it. And to bring something to the form that is unique, but not quite the form. I hate saying that. I absolutely hate saying that. Because I'm the kind of a guy who wants to stand up on the table, you know, and mount the barricades and shake my fist and sing a couple of choruses of Les Mis, because that's the kind of guy. But if you're going to get in the door, this is pretty much what you need to do.
Just
just one comment going to the publishing aspect of this. If you want some magic words, it's standalone with sequel potential.
Yeah.
That's how you write it. You write a standalone, and then you say, this could be, when it's a huge hit, this could be 3 books, this could be 5 books. But you market it as a standalone.
I can't believe what a geek I am. Somebody mentioned Chekhov, and I couldn't decide whether it was the writer or the engine.
Something to keep in mind as well is if you know you're writing a series, and your publisher knows you are, you're under contract or whatever to do that, as Julie said, it's really a good idea to wrap up whatever you've established in book one or book two and finalize and give closure to that part of the conflict. But if there's anything that I've learned from the new Battlestar Galactica series on the Sci-Fi Channel is that you resolve something and then you kick them in the guts and open up something totally new.
Or shoot them.
Because they can resurrect. But you resolve whatever conflict you've established. You bring your character to his maturation point. He's learned what he needs to learn for this segment. And then you open up the proverbial can of worms and give a dangler or whatever to a teaser, really, to bring people back. The most common question that I get when I go anywhere is, when is book three coming out? That lets me know that there was closure to the point where they still want to read my book and enough of a hook to get them to come back. Because I've read books where I didn't feel like there was closure and there was no reason to come back, either foreclosure or because they didn't entice me with something else.
Yeah, the denouement of a book that has of a series, early books in the series, is going to be different than it is for a climax book. The wrap up is going to be different. It is going to be enticing rather than resolved.
Have any of you ever experienced or worked with a series that you've done kind of I call it the Veronica Mars model, because that happens to be the show that I noticed this in, but a lot of TV shows do this, where you have a huge series arc and then smaller, like maybe your season arc and then your episode arc. Have you ever worked with that, and how do you find that works for you?
I was on a panel last year here at LTUE where we actually discussed that exact thing. I've got a five book series plan. I realize now I probably ought to just finish the whole thing for book three. Just grab 900 pages in there.
Well, that's what we did with one of our books, but I don't recommend
okay, that. Okay, good. I'm going to do five. But the thing is, I've planned out the over arc for the 5 books. And then within the 5 books, each one has its own arc. That's what I'm saying. You bring them to a point where you're closing, but you're actually setting the foundation for the next bridge for that arc. And so each book has one. I try to do it each chapter where you start and bring an arc. I don't know if I'm always successful, but that's the intention.
Yeah. Tracy mentioned writing in scenes. And Orson Scott Card talks about that as well. This type of compartmentalized way of addressing a story is, I don't know an alternative to it, to tell you the truth, because I write in scenes as well. And every scene can be viewed as an arc, right? Because you are going to develop conflict, develop situation, but there has to be some sort of resolution of a particular circumstance. And so, in a way, it seems that any long narrative form is going to involve an overall narrative arc with smaller, to a degree, individual units. At least that's the way that I approach my writing, and I can't conceptualize a different way of getting to the novel. So,
question.
Yeah.
Do you have
You don't take 15 pages to do it.
Yeah.
You can do it in a paragraph or a page.
the epilogue shouldn't be more than a page or two.
Wow.
One of those.
I'm going to disagree.
Okay. Well, now, because you're better this than I am.
I disagree with that. Actually, okay. Yeah, if you're going to set up, I'm looking at an epilogue yet. If, yeah, put in the epilogue and blow it off. To me, that feels a little forced. Okay. And just doing it in the last part of the book, to me, feels a little bit forced. If you know you're going somewhere at the end of this book, you better foreshadow that at the beginning.
If this
is something that's going to lead someplace else, it needs to be in the foundation, in the bones of this book. Not tacked on to the end, not stitched in. But it has to be integral to the structure of the book.
That's what we're looking at as an arc.
We'll come back in and be helpful to you. William Goldman says story is structure. It's all about the structure. It's all about the bones. If the bones aren't there, no matter what kind of craft you've got going here, what kind of writing you do, no matter how much chrome you pile onto it, it's not going to work. And so if you're going somewhere outside, if this is leading somewhere and taking you to a different place, see, I love the New Galactic. I didn't think I would because I'm old enough to have known the old Galactica.
And you still watch the new one?
And, you know, and I love the feathered hair, but other than that, okay? The thing that was so wonderful about the new Galactica is that the evolution of its frame, of its underlying framework, and it has evolved as the series has gone through, has evolved naturally and has moved with a solid structure from one end to the other. That's why it works. That's why you can have, you know, I mean, this is literally the equivalent of 30 full-length films by now.
Yeah.
Right? And yet it still holds together because of this underlying structure from the very beginning. Even though we didn't see it, it all peels away in layers is what works in Galactica. Even so, we now, from where we are right now, we can look back on the entire structure and see that the whole thing evolved seamlessly from the beginning. If you're going to go to a sequel from your book, if you anticipate a sequel, you don't stitch that on the end. It needs to be in the bones from the beginning.
It can be revealed.
It can
right
be
at the
revealed
very
at the end. But you have to be able at the end to look back and say, you know what? They mentioned that back in chapter 1. That was there. I missed it, but it was there all along. That's structure. That's the bones. That's where it needs to be. Everything needs to evolve naturally. We talked about organic in writing. Everything needs to be organic. Actions need to spring from motivations, and the motivations have to evolve naturally from the situations that are here. It has to be organic. You can't force it. You can't force characters. You can't force plot. It's got to all stem from the bones.
And if you have that structure, then the capstone again doesn't have to be heavy-handed. It can be very subtle. It can be concise. It can be woven into other elements of the narrative, so it doesn't feel tacked on.
Exactly.
It's not alone, and it's not functioning, and it doesn't feel like that bat upside the head by my next book, right? It's more a moment of realizing the potential for greater story than it is a now hook, right? It's not, you don't feel manipulated. You feel enticed by possibilities that you haven't realized before, and that's the difference between structure and then just a crass marketing.
Exactly.
I was going to say interesting characters.
Your first book needs to be a complete story with a complete resolution, or your readers are going to feel gypped and cheated, especially if you're a brand new author. You can't, you know, set them up for this huge series that may or may not be published depending on how well your first one sells when you don't have an audience yet. So I'd say make the first book a complete book, but make your characters so interesting that when you say, hey, there's another book coming out about these people, they'll say, I want to read that because I want to know more about those people. So if we have a question here, and then we have one back that way. Go ahead.
Going along with that, there was a book I read where I read it, and I feel like at the end, one of the major conflicts was never resolved.
And you feel cheated, right?
Because we never grounded them in our characters. If you have a character that is proactive, if you have a proactive story where the conflict and the situations are growing out of somebody doing something, not receiving something, not being acted upon, it's easier to notice because the internal growth of the character, which is sometimes easier for us to see, never comes to fruition. It's hard. It's much easier to address all of the different plot points if they are an outgrowth of characterization to a large degree. If your character is receiving, just taking the incoming fire, it's easy to forget about one of the cannons, right? But if your characters are being very proactive, if they are personally invested in these different aspects of plot that you bring to the table, you can tell a difference when you haven't addressed one because the character, you know, tells you, I'm not who I'm supposed to be. You know, the character says, something's missing. Why isn't this person who I envisioned they would become? And it's because they haven't dealt with a trial that you had set up for them to grow from.
Actually, this isn't taking it back down to a standalone book, but something I think we need to remember is I had a manuscript that I swear it had so many plot holes it could have been its own cemetery. It was just horrible. The whole thing. And the reason why was because my characters really weren't motivated to do what they needed to do. And you were talking about the organic need of a book. It needs to follow an organic sort of thread. You have to have your characters who have, they have to be properly motivated. Where are they going to cross the IB for? You know, what are their fears? What are the things that, what are they afraid to lose? You need to know those sorts of things. And then you have to wonder, okay, if they're afraid of these things and you don't actually take them to the test or the ultimate, your readers are going to feel cheated at the end because your plot's going to be filled with little holes of, well, you know, what was it, from the Da Vinci Code? It was one of the characters deathly afraid of enclosed spaces. He's incredibly claustrophobic. And yet you have him going down to the belly of the earth in one of his books. I don't even remember which one, but... And he got to this elevator and was fine. I was like, wait a minute. This guy is claustrophobic. And now he's in this elevator. He's going to the belly of this, you know, tower that's under the ground. And it's just... It was just bizarre. It's like he totally lost me at that point because he forgot what his own character's fears were. So remember, if you're going to instill your character with some sort of major dilemma, you need to carry that through the entire book to finish. It needs to be there. And if they're going to overcome it, that needs to be a really good reason for them to overcome it.
I'm
going to
give part of my wifely address this morning. The truest thing that is written is fiction. And that is because whatever is written is so. If the author puts it in the book, if he puts it in the law, in the book, it is true. And there's no external reference to tell you otherwise. If Griffin's flying in the book, then that's the way it is in the book. So the truest thing that's written is there inside the book. The author's biggest job is to make sure that what is true in the book remains true. Once you establish a rule, you must be true to it.
Internal consistency.
It must be something. Your reader will believe anything you tell them is true in the book. But don't you ever violate that. It has to be true. Always.
Okay, we have a question right here.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what do you do as writers when you're telling them, how do you keep your promises? Like, what are the specific things you do when you're writing? Ensure that when you write the end of your rough draft before you send it to your readers, that it follows through with the
promise.
Is it outlining? Is it backstory? How do you do that?
We're talking about fantasy books. Okay. Stuff I make up in my head. I just sit in my office and make up stuff. In the case, if you do that, go and make it right. I'm working on a book series with my wife right now called Dracus. Okay. For Dracus, I have on my wall a 3-foot by 4-foot color map of the terrain where the story takes place. This is rendered in incredible detail, and I have taken weeks to put together. Next to it, I have an even more detailed map of the area specific to the second book that I'm about to start. I have what I call the Ronus Compendium, which is the Bible of this world. And it tells me who the gods are. It tells me how the elves, these Nazi elves that I have in this book, they're kind of Roman Nazi elves. How their government is put together. How their society works. What all of the different groups are and how they relate to each other politically. How their gods relate to all of that. How their magic works, which they stole. Who they stole it from, which means I have a chronology now of multiple historical lines that goes back 3,000 years. That's what I mean. And you will never see this. But you will know if it isn't there. Because it's saturated in the text. It's everywhere in the text. I know these people. I know where they live. I know how they live. I visit their home. I walk with them. And in this particular book, it was the first book that's coming out hopefully later this year. In the this first book is wide-ranging. This is a book where my characters cover an awful lot of territory. And I've walked these plains with them. I have seen these mountains. I have been in these forests and visited these glades. I've crossed these savannas with them and visited these nomadic gnomes. All of that is because it is written down because it has to be consistent. I pull out my own reference books all the time to make sure that what I'm writing is true. And then I send the whole thing to my editor, who then comes back to me and fills it all with red ink, saying, "How come it says this on the internet?" And we fix it. Because it has to be true. Well, the moment you do something false, the moment you cross yourself and lie, you lose the reader. They no longer trust you.
Yeah, nothing is worse than reading logistics. A bunch of plot devices is like reading logistics. Like saying, character A needs to get to point B, and this is what I'm doing to get that character there. No reader will stick with us for that. If it isn't a genuine organic growth from motivation, from investment, from desire, then it's noticeable. Whether it's getting into an elevator with no problem when you are claustrophobic, or whether it's, you know, traveling across the continent because they have to be on the East Coast for an earthquake to happen. If it's just, this person needs to be at this place or for this circumstance to happen, you can't hide it.
I want to give you an example of how that actually is useful to you as a writer. The second book in my Bronze Canticle series was... I had characters that were moving a tremendous amount of distance through an underground kingdom. And I thought, I looked at the numbers, and they couldn't possibly walk the distance. It was just too far. It would take an inordinate amount of time for them to get from one end of this place to the other. And it made no sense in terms of the actual underground area itself. It was called the Gorman Road. And I thought, man, who would actually build a road that would just like a paved road that would go for 300 miles straight from morning to B? And so I sat back and I thought, what am I going to do? And then I had the second thought, which was, okay, let's say there is an underground road. And let's say the dwarves built an underground road that needed to span this distance. How would they solve the problem? And when I asked the question that way, I realized, wow, you know what? They wouldn't build a road. They build a canal. They use rivers, underground rivers. And so we have this incredible underground network of rivers and viaducts that were constructed so that they could, anciently, so that they could transport rafts of goods vast distances underground through this network of underground rivers. This made sense. Now that's an example where you have a plot problem, and the problem itself becomes not only a solution, but a much better story than I had before. So you have to be true, and if you run into a problem, use the problem to come up with a better solution.
Depends on who you are.
How many years you've been writing?
how well developed your world is?
How much is really kind of a guideline for that? I mean, it's individual. It's how much do you feel like you need to make it work? If you find a character, for example, who wants to tell a story about the gods, then, you better stop and decide who the gods are and where they came from and what they represent and how the people interact with them. And do they have official religions, or is this just sort of a homegrown sort of thing, and how do they worship? And then when you can answer those questions, then you can talk about the God. One of the important things here is, am I talking to them?
No, you're great.
I was afraid that I put you to sleep over there.
I was about to follow up.
Okay, I'll catch you before you go.
Okay.
One of the important things when you create these worlds is to have enough to make it make sense for you. It all has to be functional. And so that can be any amount of time. One of the things that we learned in creating fantasy worlds is that you need the shiny castle on the hill. This is part of the promise that you made. Okay? And unfortunately, I see this violated a lot. This is a promise I think that a lot of people violate. Lord of the Rings, in the book, Fellowship of the Ring, Aragorn Strider has taken the hobbits to Weathercock. Do you remember this scene? And as they're on Weathercock, the hobbits ask Strider about the place, the ruins that are here. And he tells them that this was a particular place in the story of Beren and Lúthien. And then he recites to them part of the lay of Beren and Lúthien, part of this story from their own ancient past. And it's a beautiful moment. Because here under the stars and on this, in the middle of all of these ruins, we are hearing a piece of this story and this legend. It's their history. It's their folklore. It's their roots, where they came from. And we have a sense of their past. We have the feeling that they came from somewhere and that they believe in something. And it gives us roots in the mists of their mind. Later, The Silmarillion is published. You can read the Lay of Beren and Lúthien. You can read the story of Beren and Lúthien in the Silmarillion. And you'll know it. But in the knowing of it, in it becoming fact, it loses the romance that it had in the first place. It becomes real instead of mythic. A castle is on a distant hill, and if you're riding by and you ask your friend, what is that castle? And that friend says, oh, that is the castle of sorrow. No one goes there. And you ride away. That is a romantic image. If you go up to the castle, knock on the door, look inside and see the cobwebs, it becomes real. But in doing so, it loses its romance.
A reader can tell if what they're looking at is the tip of an iceberg or just an ice cube out in the ocean.
You want the tip of the iceberg. You want to have that distance, that romance of distance, that hints that there is something beyond the horizon, something beyond where you see the characters.
But you don't have to necessarily be disappointed. We're almost out of time. We've got two more questions. So go ahead with your comments.
I was just going to say that you want the reader to see the tip of the iceberg, but for you to really give up, you have to write the whole iceberg. And that's where the world building comes in. And again, it's going to be different for every writer, but I probably have written as much on world building elements as I have for the first two novels that have been published. I have a stack of crap. Really, just no Some's organized and some of it isn't. But I had to write it first because in order for me to write and have it ring true in the book, as Tracy said, you need to know what I'm talking about. So I have to invent all of that ahead of time.
Question here first.
From the wild dogs,
I think one is to decide if you actually need two characters.
When one will do.
That's a very good strategy for giving richness to your narrative, is see if you're just making every character a single attribute of a character, which simplifies things as a writer. It's very easy for us to do, to distill things to that point, and it's artificial. Don't have every character be an attribute. Have fully fleshed out characters that serve multiple roles within your story. Don't have simple relationships between your characters with one type of interaction. And you'll find that not only will it become logistically easier for you as a writer, you don't have to spend 2,000 pages, but the story itself will grow richer and more authentic.
I'd also say make sure you know who your main characters are and keep your focus on them. Don't let your minor characters start taking over the story, and if they do, maybe you need to reconsider who the main character should be. Okay, other question here, unless you guys have more comments?
Okay. The concept of world building, you know, the paradox of Chekhov's gun. Basically, if you got a gun, it needs to be fired. But on the other hand, that creates a self-perpetuating problem, in that if you have a gun, the story must be fired. Whereas some of my favorite stories are those stories which I know there's so much more going on in the world than just what's in the story. How do you resolve that conflict of including stuff that's not part of the story so that they know there's a bigger world out there, as opposed to sticking in it, as opposed to not having promises that you can't, because you can't follow all the stories.
Really fast, I'm going to just say, I over the last couple of months read a lot of historical fiction, and I find that people who do tons and tons of research love to put tons and tons of research in their novel. And it's a point where you just need to realize, you know what, now you're boring me. I didn't want a history lesson, I just wanted to know. And it is a really fine line. So you just want to make sure that it's peppered throughout. You want to sprinkle it on, but you don't want to take off the top and pour the whole bottle over your meal. You've just ruined your meal. And I think when you're writing with world building, I have a 280-page science fiction novel. I've got 60 pages worth of what I call my cheat sheets. That's your Bible, my cheat sheet. So that I know where everything is. I know what the history is. I know it's about 60 pages of that. That stuff really isn't ever in the book. It can't be, and I need to know it so that it can be, like you said before, it's kind of absorbed into every other word that you say without being, I'm not even saying what I want to say. It's like sauteing a piece of meat. It's sucking it in, but it's not real itself. Does that make sense?
I guess so. Yeah. Does your story need the gun to go off?
If it's important enough to mention, it's important enough to resolve somehow, but it doesn't have to be fired. Maybe it's a prop, or maybe it's something that hits someone over the head, or it's...
And the world building... The world building is...
Part of the story, it's important enough to mention.
The world building is not self-indulgent. We're not, you know, imagining all these wonderful things and then telling other people because our imagination is so great. It's in service of a story. And this is the reason why 5% of the research that you do, the world that you build, is actually directly communicated to the reader. It's because you can't use almost any of it compared to all the work that you do. But when your story demands it, It's there.
It's building a framework and a structure. You don't see it as a reader, but you can tell if there is no structure as a reader because things don't add up. You can tell that the author's making it up as they go along.
Everything on the page has to have a reason. But sometimes that reason is in service of character motivation and setting. So if you're describing a great city and a character walking through that city and mulling over the bizarre politics that the city has and the character's disdain for those politics, that's setting up character motivation. All of that has to spring from an understanding of the politics of the city, the layout of the city, and the history that got them to that point. But those aspects are in service of the character and are in the book in the service of the character and setting up the motivation in the world. So if it's on the page, it has to serve the story in some aspect. If, on the other hand, you find yourself describing this incredible mystical forest just because it's cool, if it doesn't advance the plot, if it doesn't advance the character, if it doesn't go to character motivation, the plot advancement, then you know you probably could skip over the magical forest and come out the other side with your character and then move. Is either serving a purpose and it is helping and rewarding your reader or it is the experience. There's no time out. Okay? We can't say, I've given you 200 pages of great stuff, so now I'm going to take 5 to indulge the fact that I really, really love this building, so I'm going to describe it. Okay? Victor Hugo doesn't work now. Okay? There's nothing neutral. You're either revealing character, you're advancing plot, or you're hurting your story.
Sometimes when you're advancing character, so I'm gonna disagree a tiny bit in the sense that sometimes we are advancing character by having another character interact with this character. And that character isn't going to be important in the long run, but they're important right then, like the story of Aragorn. But sometimes our readers will say, well, that character was kind of cool. I want to hear more about that character, but you know what? I don't need him anymore because it serves the purpose of this character's growth. And then that's when you go onto your forum and you hear what people are saying about that one character, and then you debate. Do I want to bring him back? Do I want to fulfill that promise that I didn't know I was making, or should I just not ever bring him back? That's real life. I meet people that I never see again. So,
Thank you.
on what you just said. I think that's a great idea for a spinoff book. Let's go do it.